Environmental Natural Resources to order. Tuesday, March 15th. The records show that we do have a quorum. Members, we are going to be here as long as you want to be. We're thinking that these bills will go fairly quickly, and with your indulgence, we'll hopefully make that happen. There's going to be a couple different amendments here and there, but nothing that we can't overcome. I did mention to Senator Kielash, I believe, yesterday that we may go a half an hour over, but that remains to be seen, I guess. I don't think it's going to take that much longer. So, well, we'll start out with Senator Gimsey, Senate File 724. Welcome, Senator, to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Appreciate the opportunity to bring Senate File 724 to the committee, and we will be as quick as we can here. What this bill is a reauthorization of $2.2 million in bonding authority. In 2006, the legislature authorized these bonds, and through a series of longer negotiations and some discussions, we ran out of time. Is essentially what happened. And I have Mr. Jaski with Bowser here to explain a little bit about what happened. But I'd like, in your packets, I think we have a handout of this Grass Lake project, and there's a summary, a project summary sheet there, and also a picture of the Grass Lake project. What it is about an 1,800-acre wetland restoration project that is vital to our efforts within our community to clean up the water from a 44,000-acre watershed and get it in better condition as it moves down to some of our shallower lakes and some of our more sporting lakes downstream. It also, part of the watershed is a portion of the stormwater coming out of the city of Wilmer, and what we're doing is restoring Grass Lake in an effort to pre-treat some of that water before it goes downstream. It's a huge undertaking. It's the biggest, the way I understand, the biggest wetlands restoration project so far in the state of Minnesota. It's complex in how it has to be structured, and that has also caused, is one of the reasons why it has taken so long for us to get to the point here where we're going to start needing these dollars to actually engage in construction. And there was a lot of landowner cooperation that was required in order to make this happen, and that also contributed. But I'll turn it over to Mr. Jaski for a summary of what happened, and we'll take questions.
Welcome, Mr. Jaski, to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, John Jaski, Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources. As Senator Gimsey said, just so you know, the picture you see here is a picture of what it will look like when it's finished. There is not currently water on this piece of property. This is the trail of what it will look like once the restoration is completed. As Senator Gimsey mentioned, this project has been funded in multiple phases, and as he said, the current appropriation that we're seeking an extension for, we held it to the end because we had the opportunity to leverage some federal funding under the USDA program. We accomplished that, and there's about half of the appropriation was remaining, and the plan there was to transfer that funding to the county, Kandi Ojai County being the project sponsor, who's taking on the construction and operation of this project, which is just outside the city of Wilmer there, which you can see on the north and west corner of that photo. What happened was we had the money encumbered, and we were transferring it to the county, and the county attorney's office changed over during the election in November, and this item did not get processed at the county attorney's office. And so that's the very simple reason we're here seeking an extension.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Now, this is the bonding provision that you just want to extend the bonding provision.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Langseth, that's exactly correct.
Yeah, I remember the project. It was a good one.
So the question that I have, and maybe just to make it clear, this is not new dollars. These are dollars that were bonded in previous years, and just an extension due to some county conflict or something there then. So these are not new dollars.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. These are previously appropriated bonding dollars.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, can this bill go on its own, or doesn't it have to go into a bonding bill? Or be referred to the bonding committee or Senator Senjum's committee?
Will it be referred to Senjum, the bonding committee?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, yes. It should go to the capital investment committee, because anytime you amend a bonding provision, it should be in a bonding bill, because of the way the Constitution lays this out, that anytime you change an appropriation, you change the distinct nature of it.
Well, Mr. Chair, also, if it was in our bill here, it would take a 60% vote,
right,
and you might only get 55%.
That's a slight possibility, Senator. Any further questions? Senator Gimsey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if someone would move the bill to the Capital Investment Committee, we'd appreciate it.
Senator Scoy moves Senate File 724 to be approved and to move to the Capital Investment Committee. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Bill carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. Appreciate it.
Next on the agenda, Senate File 678, Senator Gazelka. I'm not sure if that was 55% or not, Senator Langseth. I didn't take a count there. But. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Huh? Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
End of the committee, I should say.
We might actually get out of here on time.
Oh, yes.
Quickly, Senate File 678, it's a small expansion to the game and fish lotteries that presently gives service members or veterans that have served in active duty in the prior 24 months preferential treatment in some of the hunting and fishing permits and special permits. So where this came from there was a veteran who'd been disabled and one of his friends wanted to take him out on a turkey hunt. He qualified under the present law that said if it's been in the last 24 months that you can go out on the turkey hunt. Well, the problem was once he got set up to go, his surgery caused him to have to go in and have the surgery done, and so he missed it, and then he was beyond the 24 months. And so what this legislation does specifically, if you look at 1.13, starting there, it adds somebody that has received the Purple Heart Medal for qualifying for military service as shown by official military records, or has a service-connected disability rated at 100% as defined by the United States Department of Veteran Affairs. That happens to be about 9% of soldiers that have been disabled. So I think roughly as I looked at the numbers, and they can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 360 possible applicants. So it's not a huge expansion, but it does take care of some of these. And I talked to the DNR, and I believe they're fine on this as well.
Thank you. Any questions of the senator? Would you like someone else to testify?
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mike Don Carlos, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife, DNR. I'm just here to say we support the bill.
Thank you. Any further questions? I understand this has no fiscal impact.
Correct.
That's what research says. Senator Gazelka.
I move Senate File 67 passed and is it laid over in the omnibus bill?
This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the environmental omnibus bill.
Sounds good.
Any further discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Bach is not here. Is that correct? Senator Cruz, we'll proceed with yours. Senate File 759. This is regards to the Coon Rapids Dam Commission creation. And you have some folks with you. Welcome, Senator Cruz, to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, we're Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. I'm here before you today to discuss, as the chairman mentioned, the Coon Rapids Dam. Specifically, what Senate File 759 does is twofold. The first portion of this bill reconstitute a commission that was recently dissolved because it had, for the most part, completed its work. There was one piece that that was not accomplished, so we are going to reconstitute the Coon Rapids Dam Commission. The second piece of this bill, and I'll go into a little bit more detail on these in a second. The second piece, if you turn to the back there, Section 2, is to appropriate $440,000 for a basically the engineering of the dam and also basically to get the dam to the point of construction. You should have two pieces in your folder that are going to kind of help us walk through this. The first piece is going to be the report of the first commission that just recently finished its work. You're going to see a letter on the top from the commission, starting off with Governor Dayton on there, an address to some of the chairs of the committee. The second piece is going to be a report by Stanley Consultants, which is going to be a vital piece of what we talk about here. I guess where I'd like to start is do a little bit of history of where we're at here. In January of 2010, the Three Rivers Park District asked the legislature to create the Coon Rapids Dam Commission. The purpose of that was to study and make recommendations for the future of the dam. You have a copy of that legislation. If you look on, I believe it is page 23 of the commission report, you will see that original legislation and the duties that are defined in there. The commission shall study options and make recommendations for the future of the Coon Rapids Dam, including its suitable public uses, governance, operation, and maintenance and financing of the dam and its operations. Essentially, all of the duties that were listed there were completed except one. That one issue is the future ownership and operation of the dam. As I'm sure many of you committee members can understand, it's a very large fiscal responsibility to manage a dam. So there's been some discussion about who should take the responsibility of that moving forward. The reason that this is kind of a hot-button issue for us, if you will, is the invasive species concern. If you look here, if you look in the Stanley report on page 3, for those of you that aren't familiar with Asian carp, you're going to see a picture of what can be up to a 100-pound flying fish. And essentially what these Asian carp do are eat everything in its path, to put it lightly. They're not good for fisheries. They're not good for the environment. So definitely what we would classify as an invasive species. In February of 2010, the DNR stated that the Coon Rapids Dam now serves as a de facto barrier to upstream migration of fish that were formerly blocked by the St. Anthony Falls. Now, these fish include potentially Asian carp. In August of 2010, the DNR, with Three Rivers serving as a fiscal agent, contracts with Stanley Engineering, and that's the report that you have in front of you right here, to undertake the Coon Rapids Dam Fish Barrier and Improvements Preliminary Design. Essentially, what came out of this design was the opportunity for a 50-year fix that would essentially outfit this existing dam for the purpose of a fish barrier and also allow for future hydroelectric power to be used in the dam. So, which is in concordance with the commission report. The Coon Rapids Dam Commission began its report after being commissioned in September of 2007. In January of 2011, the Stanley report concludes that the Coon Rapids Dam could function as a fish barrier with a 99.9 effectiveness rating. The estimated cost of this is going to be right around $17 million. Part of the reason that we're before you here today asking for the $440,000 is that we want to be fiscally responsible. We want to make sure that we shore up exactly what that is. So we feel that the commission felt that an important part of that that is getting that preliminary design done, getting it right to the point of groundbreaking before we would come before the legislature potentially asking for any additional dollars. If the design work were to begin in the summer of 2011, which is what this legislation would do, construction could be potentially completed by late 2013. Now, it's important to look at those numbers because we have this concern with the Asian carp. Right now, that could potentially invade that area of the river at just about any time. You know, it's popped up in lakes and streams all around Minnesota. The danger here is if this Asian carp does get past this Coon Rapids barrier, it could potentially damage a $4 billion a year fishing and recreation industry. So that's why we're before you here today, and I'm going to turn that over to my testifiers here, and they'll be able to tell you a little bit more about it.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Vondelinde. I'm Director of Parks and Recreation for Anoka County. I've had the pleasure of serving as Anoka County's representative on the Coon Rapids Dam Commission over the past 5 months, and I'm very pleased to report to you today that the Anoka County Board of Commissioners wholeheartedly supports the recommendation of the Coon Rapids Dam Commission, which includes the repair and maintenance of the dam, the modification of the dam for the Asian carp, and the continuation of the Coon Rapids Dam Commission. These recommendations were made following 12 meetings and 15 of the 15-member commission and two public meetings spanning a period of 5 months. During that process, careful consideration was given to the ecological, economic, and recreational attributes of the Coon Rapids Dam and to the public input process. I do want to mention that the majority of the comments we received from the public were to leave the dam in place, to repair the dam, and to modify it to serve as a barrier for invasive species, including the Asian carp. Anoka County appreciates the consideration that this committee is giving to Senate File 759. In the written and oral testimony that's been given to us by the Minnesota DNR and again last evening by Dr. Sorensen from the University of Minnesota at the LCCMR hearing, it is clear that the Asian carp poses a potentially significant threat to the recreation and tourism industry of the state, as Senator Cruz just mentioned. The modification of the Coon Rapids Dam is one very important measure, not necessarily the only measure, but an important measure in preventing the spread of this aggressive fish into northern Minnesota. And additionally, I want to provide just a little context on the park itself. At the Coon Rapids Dam, we have one of the most heavily used parks in the North Metro area with over 700,000 visitors per year at Coon Rapids Dam Regional Park. The dam provides a recreational pool for tens of thousands of visitors who enjoy fishing, boating, and canoeing both above and below the dam. The dam also provides a very significant connecting link in the Metro Regional Park system between Hennepin and Anoka counties with a regional trail across the dam. And the dam also serves to protect property values and to maintain the tax base both in Anoka and Hennepin counties. Given the Asian carp issue and the need for expediency in the dam modifications, Anoka County supports the funding in Senate File 759 to begin the design and the engineering process for the Coon Rapids Dam as soon as possible. Additionally, Anoka County agrees with the continuation of the commission, as noted in Senate File 759, to allow the commission more time for research, analysis, and decision-making, both by state and local governments represented on the commission and located near the Coon Rapids Dam, to develop a governance and finance model going forward that best meets the long-term needs and interests of the region and the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Any questions of the witness?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, members of the committee, my name is Mark Uglum. I'm the mayor of the city of Champlin, and I'm also one of the tri-chairs of the Coon Rapids Dam Commission.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Another committee meeting for you guys. But, you know, I got to tell you, when I got appointed to the commission, I went down there, and I was all set to represent the interests of our city. And it is important. The Coon Rapids Dam is important to the city of Champlin and the surrounding cities of Coon Rapids, Anoka, and Brooklyn Park because it does provide a recreational pool, and the park is very important to us. But then the DNR came along, and we got the letter from the DNR from the Commissioner of Lands and Waters about the Asian carp and the potential infestation of Asian carp. And make no mistake about it, this isn't European carp. We've been living with them for 100 years. These are the flying carp. And they have the potential to change the Minnesota way of life in the North Country. You can end up with premier lakes like Mille Lacs, and I need to remind you maybe from the geography standpoint, Coon Rapids Dam is right here. Just north of it is the Rum River, and north of that is Mille Lacs. And, of course, the Mississippi River and Crow River systems. Mississippi, I happen to have a lake home on Leech Lake, and we've spent many, many times and hours working on improving the walleye fishery in Leech Lake. And in a few years, the Asian carp could destroy all of that. This is the biggest invasive species issue, I think, that's hit this state in many years. There's been a lot of publicity about it. And the DNR and the University of Minnesota have confirmed that this is a huge issue. It's an economic issue in the terms of $4 billion, but it's an economic issue for Main Street. Whether it be the guy that runs the corner gas station in your town, filling up the boats, whether it be the barber, whether it be the grocery store, or anybody. It may take some time, but it could destroy that infrastructure. The Coon Rapids Dam would be the first effective barrier, 99.9%, in stopping this. Nothing's 100%. There's been talk of closing lock and dam number one, but in my opinion, and with a commission examine this, would take an act of Congress. Good luck on that. And we're afraid, too, that the resulting lawsuits because of the interruption of commerce would be huge. And we don't want to put people out of business. That's important to us. So the Coon Rapids Dam remains the most vital link in stopping this invasive species to the upper Mississippi River, Mille Lacs, and other lakes like that. It's very important. John mentioned the needs of the cities and things, and that's important to us, too. I'd be remiss not to say that. But I became convinced that there's a bigger issue here besides just little old city of Champlin and Coon Rapids, and I'm here to tell you that. The bill also... I got to say, too, that it's very important. Time is of the essence on this thing. The DNR has told us that in anywhere from 2 to 10 years, the Asian carp could be at the Coon Rapids Dam. 2 to 10 years. That's a very short time frame when you're rebuilding a dam. So time is of the essence. We know money is tight, but we need to move forward on this. As far as extending the commission, the timeline on the commission and everything else, we did leave one thing that was unfinished for us, and we could not determine the governance of the dam. Simply put, Three Rivers would like to probably get rid of the dam and turn it over to the DNR. The DNR probably doesn't want it. The cities have examined the idea of hydroelectric power, and we haven't taken that off the table yet. And there is a possibility that given some time, we would have a joint powers agreement among the cities and try to generate electric power from an environmental standpoint. So there's a number of issues that are unanswered for the governance of the dam, and we would beg that we could continue those studies. It's a free commission. It doesn't cost anything. We're all donating our time. That we could get the governance issues straightened around and do the job right. We don't want to hurry that. So we are in support of this bill. Senator Cruz has been a great champion for us, and it's a statewide issue. We would very much like you to give your utmost consideration to the Coon Rapids Dam. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Saxler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor, Senator Carlson, Senator Skoy, Senator Kasalka, Senator Peterson, myself, we are all concerned about the Mississippi River above the dam, and I appreciate the fact that you guys are all and gals are all doing this for free, this dam commission. But If we're gonna put money into a dam like this, and it appears to me that it's one of the better ways of stopping the carp, I think I'd like to delve a little bit more into who's going to be running that dam ultimately, if I'm up above it, and I'm thinking about my fisheries.
Oh yeah.
And what the future's going to be. So. Would Senator Cruz, would you offer any other alternatives in terms of who would possibly be in line to be in charge of that dam? Would that be the DNR or the Corps of Engineers or who?
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxok, I think you bring up a great point. I would definitely want the legislature to have a say in who does ultimately take control of the dam. I think there will be an opportunity to do that. I think the implementation of this commission is strictly to have a conversation about that and make a recommendation to the legislature. I think at that point, the legislature would have an opportunity to decide one way or another who ultimately would take control of that dam. So I don't think by instituting this commission we lose that opportunity. I do want to keep that. My thought is this. I'm a big fan of local control as much as possible. I do see the broader picture in this, though, and I think that's why it's important to have this conversation. I think ultimately if we can put together a small group of cities in a joint power situation with hydroelectric power funding, continuing repairs on the dam, maintenance of the dam, I think that would potentially be a good thing. I think that's why we need to have this conversation.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cruz, I'm not a big fan of local control when it involves the northern 300-400 miles of the Mississippi River. So, even before we do this commission, I'd like to have some idea of what our alternatives are in terms of who would ultimately be running that dam.
Senator Saxog, if I could interject just a little bit here. We're getting a little off target, but I certainly appreciate the conversation. The governor, I know, has got this in his bonding bill. The actual, I think, is 16 or – I mean, there's different numbers around here, $16 million, and there has been talk about it being turned over to the DNR. Now, whether the DNR wants that or not, I guess that remains to be seen as far as the discussion moving forward. But I'm with you. When it's taking in this much of the state, northern part of the state is affected by it, local control may not be the answer. I agree with that. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I know there's a bonding proposal for almost $17 million. I mean, what would it cost to buy a dam? I mean, if the DNR were to pursue taking over the Coon Rapids Dam? It sounds a little spendy to me.
To that point, Senator Squay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. To that point, I think the question isn't who's going to control the dam, but who has the financial responsibilities for the dam. I mean, this dam was given to the watershed district, 50-some years ago or whatever it was, and part of the deal was they got land for a park. Well, it's 50 years has gone by, and now somebody's got to be responsible for fixing it. So, in your discussions of paying and everything, you got to keep that all in mind, too, because, you're going to have to fix it up again at some 50-year point.
Mm-hmm. And if I might, too, if you look at the makeup of the commission, you've got folks that are from the DNR. You've got folks from Met Council and everybody, and I think that discussion would go on with this commission and come back with their recommendations. And I think that's what generally where we're at, Senator.
On that point, I was looking at the makeup of the commission as it was constituted, that made this report that we recently got. And there seems to be just basically one change, and that's adding the Commissioner of Commerce to the commission members. And I'm wondering what was the thinking behind adding that Commerce Commissioner?
Senator, staff has some input.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should address that. Last year's bill inadvertently said the Commissioner of Energy. We don't have a Commissioner of Energy. We have a Deputy Commissioner of Energy. So in rewriting the bill this year, I thought it would be more important to just put the Commissioner of Commerce, because then the Commissioner of Commerce can put whoever they want to on it, which would likely be the Deputy Commissioner.
Okay. Makes sense. Thank you.
Senator Scoy, and then Kielash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, let me be clear. I'm strongly supportive of the fish barrier at the Coon Rapids Dam, but I think we have questions about ownership. The question I have is maybe Senator Langseth or somebody else. Can you use bonding money for this pre-design stuff?
Senator Langseth.
No, I don't believe for pre-design.
Yeah, okay.
You can.
Yes.
I was wondering about that one. This appears to be cash money.
That was my question, too, is perhaps it might be more appropriate to run this $440,000 instead of out of the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund to run it through the bonding committee and bond for that pre-design.
I think that's certainly a possibility. However, the discussion has been tirelessly, I might add, brought to the, as Senator Higgins can attest to the LCCMR, emerging issues over the last 3 weeks. We've been discussing this as being one of those. And I guess I can't report that the whole commission went along with it. Actually, they didn't. They went along with their previous proposals that were written before the change in membership. As you, well, I'm sorry, Senator Scott, you've been there. You've been involved in it as well. So,
the only thing is, you know, a lot of times if you can, especially during times when cash money is hard to come by, if you can use bonding money and low interest rates and spread the costs over the lifetime of the project, makes some economic sense to do that. It's just, I didn't want to get into the LCCMR debate now. I was just thinking at a higher level. A lot of times, instead of cash money.
Okay, Senator Higgins says she's going to. So go ahead, Senator Higgins.
Well, Mr. Chair, after our discussion last night and LCCMR, I was thinking about the restrictions that we have on the use of the funds through the Environmental Trust Fund. And there's also a subdivision in statute about the things the money cannot be spent for. And I can't find any way that this pre-design money for a dam can fit into the trust fund requirements or exceptions. And in fact, one of the exceptions is projects or purposes inconsistent with the strategic plan. And LCCMR, the commission puts together its strategic plan, I think, every funding cycle. And then they have to work within those parameters. And this clearly isn't part of the strategic plan items. So it really doesn't fit in what you all did last night. And what this bill proposes to do. So I think that's a problem with the bill, you know, where the money would come from.
Thank you. Maybe I could defer to Mr. Knopf about that. My feeling is when you talk about LCCMR dollars, we're talking about the environment, and this is definitely an environmental issue. It's not about hydro. It's not about pooling water together for boating and recreation. It's about an emerging issue of some I think severity, and that's to react real quickly here for the flying carp. So how do you read that? Do you have it in front of you, the same statute?
I do not, Mr. Chairman.
You've been around for a few years with LCCMR and monitoring that. Does this fit with the funding of LCCMR or with taking those into consideration?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's a little different from some other things that are funded through LCCMR. I mean, it does talk about capital projects, but it's for the preservation and protection of unique natural resources. So the question is this a unique natural resource? It does also prohibit projects or purposes inconsistent with the strategic plan. If this isn't in the strategic plan, that'd be inconsistent. But the truth of the matter is the legislature can still bypass any law when it's appropriated money. Even if it weren't to fit, the specific law will always override the general. So if you appropriate the money for it, it wouldn't be illegal because you wrote these laws and you're writing this new law.
Let me ask this question, then maybe it'll clarify the bill as it sits right now, so we can move on. If we went ahead and passed this bill today in its form, and there happened to be some discussion down the line about bonding, which we all know there will be, can this money then be directed out of the bonding fund, and this bill would just, in fact, go away?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the question is what part of the process this is in. If it's still being discussed in conference committee, you can drop it at that point in time. If it's on the way to, I mean, the governor could line item veto it, I guess, if there's going to be a bonding bill. I mean, there are options you could do down the road. You could even undo something you did during the session, yeah, if you needed to.
So it's practical enough that we could pass this today, and if that work happens to take a precedent, then we would certainly consider that.
Mr. Chairman, that you can do that.
Yes. Seem okay. Okay. All right. Yeah. Senator Kielash.
I'm not so up on the funding part, but I just had a couple questions because of some of the things I've recently heard about the Coon Rapids Dam, and they may be addressed by the commission. I'm just trying to get some clarification. And when I look at the slides, one of the things that makes it not as effective a barrier, I was told, is that they can just do an end around and go through the old powerhouse pond, and I'm not sure if that's been addressed or talked about in the commission. Can you give me some update on that?
Yes, it has been.
Mr. Mayor, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Senator, it has been addressed at the commission, and that is not the case. They won't go around that, the old powerhouse deal.
Okay. The other thing I
follow up.
Mr. Chair, sorry. The other thing I'd heard is that this isn't going to be tall enough to keep them from going over the top of it, and because of their ability to leap so high and against heavy currents, et cetera. And I'm not sure if that's been addressed in this or not. One of the things that they say is the most effective barrier is to either shut down a lock and dam or else, you know, prevent them from being able to enter the locks and dams when boats are moving through. Can you just give me a little background on that?
Senator Kielash, if I might, before he does that, line 2.15 addresses your issue.
Which one?
But go ahead, Mr. Mayor.
2.1.
Senator, I was going to say that the Stanley report goes into quite some detail about the ability of the carp to breach the dam. And nothing's perfect. I can't sit here and tell you it's 100%. But we've had one of the best engineering firms in the country that does work on dams and everything else do this report at the direction of the DNR. And the report's conclusion are a 99.9% effective rate of deterring the carp. There's always, you know, the situation like in Japan or whatever, you know, the unforeseen. But this, we should look at this as being the first most vital barrier to taking care of this. And there should be some redundancy. There should be some redundancy. And I think this is the quickest, best way to start. But this is not an issue that's going to go away. You need redundancy somewhere up the line.
One quick follow up. And would there be an issue if they did need to raise the dam with the pool behind it as far as damage to current homes or any of that, if they raise it a foot or something?
Mr. Mayor.
Senator, we had public hearings on this. We had two public hearings. And here I am, an elected official in Champlin. I have not had a single phone call from any of our residents. We did have one individual that spoke at the public hearing about that. The issue would be having a pool up in the wintertime and some possible ice damage. But I think everybody, my constituents at least, are saying, hey, we're willing to put up with that. It doesn't seem to be a big deal. The Asian carp situation is much bigger. So there has been, like I say, on record, only one individual.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Mayor, I was interested in your comment about the redundancies upriver. I
think the redundancy should be downriver so that as few carp as possible can get to the Coon Rapids Dam. And we need to make sure that there are barriers, you know, from Iowa on up rather than, you know, just staking all of our claim right at the Coon Rapids Dam. Because otherwise, I mean, you know, I guess over the years I've become a kind of a belt and suspenders kind of person. You know, you need to do just more than one thing. And so I'm glad that you, you know, recognize that this isn't going to be the be-all and end-all. It's just one of our strategies. Because I was looking at this nice color report that y'all did, and on about the sixth page where the picture of all the jumping carp are, and if the Coon Rapids Dam becomes the place that all the carp go and stay, the part of the Mississippi that you know is next to my district will look like this. And I don't know if maybe the DNR or somebody can tell us, how are we going to deal with all of these carp when they get into, you know, like from St. Anthony Falls, Lock and Dam to Coon Rapids Dam, and we've got that whole part of the river where they can't go anywhere, they're going to stay there, but the barge traffic will be hindered, the recreational boaters will be gone, the river rats, water skiing crew will not be able to be there. I mean, what are we going to do with that part of the river then? And I don't know if somebody from DNR, is Mr. Lockesmore around? I don't know.
Is there anybody that could come and give a short testimony here? Then I think we need to move on. We did have an invasive species presentation, but go ahead. We've got a representative from the DNR that could quickly give us a... Give Senator Higgins a little idea. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Member Steve Hirsch, DNR, Director of Ecological and Water Resources. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I don't really have a great answer to your question. You know, if we do have a barrier, there is a chance that fish will concentrate, you know, below that during certain times. But there's not a lot of good alternatives here. If we don't stop them there and we let them disperse upstream, you know, we've already talked about what some of those impacts might be. So I do agree with the comment that we need redundancy, and I do agree that that redundancy, we'd better do that redundancy downstream rather than upstream.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hirsch, thank you for those comments. You know, I agree. We got to have redundancy in here, and I think there's efforts being made. We heard last night that there's a researcher working on these pheromones or whatever they are where they're going to attract the fish over. There's research being done on whether they can inject nitrogen into the lock areas, which is very detrimental to fish. So there's a lot of work going on to work downstream to prevent these fish from going up. I think having a physical structure like the Coon Rapids Dam makes a lot of sense. With regard to the height issues, from what I understand, they're going to redo the gates. They currently have these floating gates. They're going to change that out and make it harder for the fish to get across them and everything. The only question I have is, you know, whether we shouldn't consider bonding, and I think I heard the chair said that we would consider that. But, you know, we had full detailed discussion about this in the LCCMR committee last night, and I think we're making some progress on it, but, you know, we still need to do what we need to do with the Coon Rapids Dam.
It's all been good information, there's no question. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. Senator Gazelka, would you please move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 759.
Referred to State Government Innovation and Veterans.
And referred to State Government Innovation and Veterans.
Any further discussion?
Senator
Skoy.
Is this bill then at some point going to run through the bonding committee in case it should end up there?
You know, I think the discussion was that if it ends up there, we're certainly open to do that. I think that'd be a good package deal. That'd be a good way to approach it if there's going to be a bonding bill moving forward. That's the question. So.
Okay. Thank you.
All in favor of the bill? Say aye.
Aye.
Both same sign? So carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Senator Rosen.
Senate File 435. Welcome to the committee.
One of your committee, Mr. Chair and members.
You have 3 minutes.
I can talk fast. Mr. Chair, Senate File 435 basically deletes the mandatory rule that requires an automatic EAW, the Environmental Assessment Worksheet, for construction or expansion of an ethanol facility or fuel conversion facility of 5 million gallons. This mandatory rule is outdated and imposes an unnecessary burden on Minnesota ethanol facilities and industry. It's not competitive at all with our surrounding states.
Excuse me, Senator, did you have an author's amendment?
I do have the A2 amendment.
Let's move that and get the bill in shape. Has it been passed out?
I'm a co-author on the bill. I'll offer the A2 amendment.
Okay. Senator Scoia offers the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Please proceed. Sorry.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoia, I appreciate it. And basically, the author's amendment just kind of clarifies the language, takes it away from the rules, puts it into statutes, but also gives the EQB board the authority to take a look at this. But if I could also direct you, members, to the green handout. That really does explain a lot of it. And just a little historical background. I know I'm talking fast because now I've been given the...
I was only kidding about
the green. Okay. This mandatory category for ethanol facilities was established in 1982 when the state produced only 1 million gallons of ethanol per year. And now we have currently 21 facilities. And in 2010, we had a capacity of 1.117 billion gallons of ethanol. A Minnesota ethanol facility is strictly regulated through laws and rules controlling our potential environmental impacts, including regulation of air emissions, water discharges, and water appropriation. And these are governed and ruled through the PUC and the DNR. Most of these regulations did not exist when this mandatory EAW category was created back in 1982. And again, I want to just direct you back to the second page. Excuse me, on the bottom of the green sheet. The other mandatory categories listed where a facility would have a mandatory EAW would be if the local government or the state agency asked for one under their discretion, or if the citizens can petition for EAW, they only have to get 25 signatures from anywhere around the world for one. There's other mandatory categories, and that's on the second page of the green sheet, Exhibit A, that the ethanol facility would fall under. And also back in 2005, I believe we passed the legislation that a mandatory EIS. Excuse me, I'm not going to go into that. But the Granite Falls ethanol plant was built in 2005. And they did have an EAW, but it was asked through the Environmental Quality Board if they would have had to had one. And they would have, because they would have fallen under these regulations already. So there's already a rigorous permitting process in place. And it really makes this mandatory rule for the fuel conversion facilities unnecessary. So the bill basically takes that out and leaves it up to all the other mandatory categories that are in place. And, Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Peter Larson with me.
Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, Peter Larson, Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I'm here for the Minnesota Coalition for Ethanol. And I appreciate your time on this. Senator Rosen really provided an explanation. I just wanted to add a couple points. Number one, we just want to make it clear we're not asking for any sort of exemption here. We just want, if the legislature is willing, to make it clear that it's no longer necessary to require an EAW for a 5 million gallon ethanol plant. The ethanol facilities that are built now, as you can see on the back of the green page, the last 9 facilities were between 48 million and 110 million gallons. And again, this mandatory category was created when the entire state only made 1 million gallons. And just so I can point out the importance of this to the ethanol facilities, you can see the Winthrop. It's Winthrop parentheses Heartlands. It's Heartlands Heartland Corn Products. It's 1, 2, 3, 4 down. Just to give you an example, that facility was built. It was a 10 million gallon plant. It did an EAW. It expanded to 19 million gallons. It did an EAW. Expanded to 35 million gallons. It did an EAW. It expanded to 99 million gallons. It did an EAW. Its last expansion was 4.9 million gallons. It didn't have to do an EAW. And that's the type of thing that we're really trying to address here is all of these facilities have done EAWs. There's been 39 in the state, and we'd really like to just get back in an ordinary kind of process where if there should be an EAW should be done. We're not asking for an exemption. We just think it's time to not have this mandatory category anymore, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions. Other than I will say that I asked John Larson from the EQB. I gave him the most recent ethanol expansion EAW, and I asked him his opinion. Would this facility have to do an EAW even if this mandatory category that we're talking about today didn't exist? And I meant to ask him just about the original 50 million gallon plant, and he said not only would the 50 million gallon plant would have had to do an EAW under a different mandatory category because of its size, but this 30 million gallon expansion also would have had to do an EAW because of the size of the project. And I've got an email from him. I don't know if you want to see it, but I'm just saying that to make it clear that we're not asking for any sort of an exemption. In fact, the last EAW that was done on an ethanol plant would have been a mandatory category anyway, and we're fine with that. That's the way it should work. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Larson, if I could, just for clarification of the committee, I understand that these permits would have traditionally been paid for by the MPCA, and what is the normal cost?
Well, I asked in order to not just give you my opinion, Mr. Chair, I asked an engineer that I work with often who's done a lot of these, and you have typical costs of an ethanol facility EAW on this green sheet. For a new facility, cost anywhere from $25,000 to $300,000. Time to do it would be anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. For an expansion, those numbers change a little bit, $25,000 to $75,000. My personal opinion is these numbers are low, but I just wanted to ask him the question and give you the answer he gave me.
Okay, thank you. Senator Kielash.
Just a quick question. The 5 million gallons was the low mark, or what's the – when does the EAW kick in now as far as gallons goes or with the different statutes? Can you give me an idea so that we're changing it from something to what? I guess that's
who wants to take that?
Mr. Chair, thank Senator. You. Senator Kielash, when this was first in place in 1982, the ethanol plants were 10 to 15 million gallons. And so 5 million seemed to be a good benchmark. And now these are expanding anywhere from 4.9 to whatever. So
My question is that I realize that we're trying to get rid of that, but I don't know what's replacing it as far as there are minimum number of millions of gallons that replaces that to when an EAW is required. At what level is that?
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Larson, but there's other mandatory EAW categories, but I don't think there's a...
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, balance. Senator Kielash, I think the answer is probably best represented on Exhibit A. There wouldn't be a mandatory category anymore based on the capacity of the facility. Okay. They would instead be in the same position as other projects in greater Minnesota or in the Twin Cities, but probably not going to be an ethanol facility at Twin Cities. So you can see, for example, I told you that John Larson said that this most recent facility would have had to do an EAW. Mm-hmm. If you look at what's subpart 14 there, which talks about mandatory categories based on the square footage of a project, that's the one that he said both the existing facility when it was built and this expansion that's now being built would trigger a mandatory category under that provision.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, too, if I could just say that. Thank you. The last four of the ethanol plants in the state, 330 million of those gallons are in my Senate district. I have over half the ethanol produced in my Senate district that's produced in the state. And if any of the senators have gone through a process of permitting and regulation with one of these plants, you know that is well taken care of at the DNR and at the PCA. So we're just taking away this very innocuous mandatory category that is well placed well served by all the other mandatory categories in Exhibit A.
Any further questions? We do have another testifier, Jim Urkel, Land Use and Transportation Director from MCEA. Mr. Urkel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Urkel. I'm with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I had two handouts that I'd ask the, if the pages could hand those out. As was explained.
Excuse me, I don't know if we got those or not. Did we? Okay, yes, we did.
Okay. The House file or Senate file 435 eliminates the mandatory EAW threshold for ethanol plants. As a result, there would be nothing specific for ethanol plants between the categorical exemption that exists right now for facilities having capacities of less than 500,000 gallons a year and the mandatory EIS threshold for facilities capable of producing 125 million gallons a year outside of the seven-county regions. And if you look at the list, you'll see that in terms of the EIS, the mandatory EIS threshold, none of the existing plants would have tripped that that requirement. It's argued that the petitions for EAWs and discretionary EAWs would be an adequate means for the public to engage on proposals relating to ethanol plants. In theory, that might be true, but as Albert Einstein is once reported to have said, in theory and practice are the same. In practice, they're not. The public may not know about the proposals in time to petition or to advocate that an RGU undertake environmental review. It becomes something of a hide-and-seek exercise for the public. And for proponents of a plant, they lose the certainty that a threshold provides, knowing that they have to hit it and would have to worry about the public policy equivalent of walking around in a storm waiting to be hit by lightning. The bill relies on other mandatory EAW thresholds for opportunities for environmental review of proposals for ethanol plants. However, there's really no good reason for this bill unless it's not intended to reduce the number of plants that would be subject to environmental review. In addition, by eliminating the threshold, the bill also eliminates the designation of MPCA as the RGU for ethanol plants. We've seen how budget problems at the state level have pushed costs down onto the local level. If a proposal trips the threshold for an industrial expansion, let's say, will a city or a county, are they going to be a reluctant governmental unit or a responsible one to handle this new environmental mandate? The bill also basically tells EQB not to look at the number of gallons that are produced in the plant as a way of dealing with the designations and the
Mr. Urkel, if I could just stop you for a second. Maybe you need some clarification with regards to the amendment. Would have staff do that for you, please, with regards to the MPCA.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Urkel, you talked about that the PCA would not now be the RGU. The original bill did delete a provision of the environmental review law that stated that. This provision does not do that. It says that, it would still be up to the EQB as to who the RGU is, but it doesn't really take out the PCA as the RGU.
Mr. Chair, so if it's not required, if a mandatory EAW is not required other than by tripping another mandatory threshold, and that mandatory threshold identifies a different RGU than the PCA, is the PCA going to continue being the RGU?
Mr. Knopf. Chairman, Mr. Urkel, that could be true as far as if it's an industrial, commercial, or institutional.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Please proceed.
In terms of the 1982 sonar, it is true that at that time the industry was fairly small, but EQB was talking about, or in the sonar, they talk about how the technology that fuel conversion facilities for alcohol production are generally viewed as having lesser potential for significant environmental impact than peat expansion and things like that. In addition, the technology for alcohol production has been tested and applied. Consequently, more data on environmental impacts is available. These facilities have the potential for significant impacts with regard to water pollution, odors, transportation systems, and land use patterns. So, and they understood that the industry was going to be expanding. That's why they set the standards as they had. It would be a different question if the plants didn't have a somewhat sketchy track record in terms of environmental protection. And I'd point you to the two handouts that show that over the last 10 years that there have been 15 plants that have been that have paid fines either in the form of administrative penalties or in stipulated agreements that total more than $3 million. And in terms of enforcement actions versus inspections, rather than getting better, you can see from this that they're actually getting a little worse, that the trend is running up rather than down.
Excuse me, Mr. Urkel. Senator Rosen, to that point?
To that point, thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, I actually have a bill that I'm introducing to address these penalties because back, I'm not sure if it was 08 or 09, we allowed the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to keep their fines, to allow them to keep their fines. So they went from about $90,000 to almost $3 million in fines, most of them directed towards the ethanol industry. So I'm digging into that, and there's a smell test on this one.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's this track record that has created a lot of public interest and concern about the plants and the potential threat that they represent to air quality, water quality, and increasingly water quality. It's true that these are permitting difficulties. However, as the legislative auditor's report recently just said, one of the goals of environmental review is to help the public understand the threats to their communities by setting up one spot where all of the information relating to the proposal is housed and which can then inform both the public and the regulating agencies. We don't see the need for reducing the amount of environmental review of an industry that hasn't yet shown that it can be fully trusted. Even if it could be, the solution would be to task EQB with considering a modification of the threshold, not eliminating it. By using the rulemaking process instead, there would be opportunities for the plants and the public to engage in a deliberative way on balancing the needs of information and the costs. This bill, on the other hand, is like bringing an axe rather than a scalpel into the operating room. Thank you.
Members, any questions? Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Urkel, I have a question for you. Back in 1982, when these rules were set up, it states that one of the rules for EAW was because of the fact that this practice was highly untested and it was something fairly new. Today we're producing, 1.1 billion gallons of ethanol a year? So wouldn't that show that we've now had the practice tested and that maybe there's not a reason to continue with this?
Mr. Urkel?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the quote that I read from the sonar also talks about what was expected or anticipated at the time, that even then the technology was fairly well known and could be tested. And I think the handout showing the stipulated agreements and administrative penalty orders over the last 10 years suggests that they haven't gotten it right yet.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Follow-up.
Mr. Urkel, you're bringing up the penalties. My question would be, do you have a chart that would show the relationship of the penalties to the number of EAWs a specific plant has done? So, here you've got North Star Ethanol, Lake Crystal. They had started in 2005. They had a penalty here in June 12th of 2007. Do you have anything that can show the relationship that the more EAWs are being done, that means that the number of penalties is going down? Do you have that relationship? You could show me that.
Mr. Urkel.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. But the chart does show both penalties being assessed or on new and old plants, that those are moving forward, and the trend seems to be running in that direction. In terms of whether or not environmental review will help solve those problems, that depends on how the environmental review is performed and whether or not the agencies take advantage of environmental review to coordinate all of the permitting, look at all of what's been going on, so that the next time that Heartland Corn Products comes up for an expansion, we know that there have been at least twice in the last 10 years they've been hit with penalties, and perhaps that will be discussed in the environmental review and taken into consideration.
Members, any other questions? Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to point out a couple things. First, if you look at the green page, these last nine facilities are generally pretty big. They each did an EAW. They didn't do an EIS because the PCA determined, as they're required to do, that these facilities didn't have the potential for significant environmental effects. That's what they had to determine. The PCA did on each one of these. So the PCA determined for each one of these facilities did not have the potential for significant environmental effects. Now, we don't want to exempt those facilities. I can make an argument that we know enough that we shouldn't have to do EAWs, but we're not here to do that today. The other thing I'll point out, just as an example, the April 16th, 2009 Guardian Energy enforcement action, and I could give you a long discussion of what we've been doing with the PCA over the last year. We have a very good relationship with them to work through these issues. But just as an example there, that facility was purchased from VeriSun. They did some construction that was inconsistent with the plans that they had submitted to get their air permit. So before they even ground a bushel of corn, they were penalized because they built something incorrectly. And I could go through many of these and talk to you about each of them and tell you that I don't want to absolve these folks from the penalties they should have paid, but I can go through most of these and tell you they had nothing to do with environmental issues. They had no air emissions or water emissions problems. They were issues that were important but did not threaten the environment. So, you know, we could go through these issues, but I just wanted to point out that one. For example, they paid the penalty. They should have. It was appropriate work by the staff, but it shouldn't be represented as being an environmental threat.
Members, any further questions? Senator Hall.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 435 be included, possibly included into the environmental budget bill.
That would be as amended?
As amended, yes.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Is there a possibility this could be moved straight to the floor? Do you object to that?
We could do, Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, not that. I just want to make known that there is a preliminary fiscal note on it. There would be a slight loss of there's not a cost to it, but potentially a slight loss of revenue to the environmental fund of only $40,000 per year. So I just want to point that out before. It's not that it has a cost to it, but. Okay. And it's a preliminary fiscal note right now because I couldn't get it done in time. So.
We could certainly do that if that's the wishes to move to the floor, directly to the floor. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, would you?
I change my move then. I move Senate File 435 be moved to the floor.
Recommended to go to the floor.
As with amendment.
As amended. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, and members. Thank you.
Senator Bach, if I could indulge you 1 second. Senator Hall does have to be at another one in 10 minutes, and I think is going to go real quick. Thank you. Senator Hall, Senate File 692. I understand this is a department bill, and you have with you today a guest.
Yes, I do. He's been around a little bit. Assistant Commissioner,
Bob Meyer.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. This is a technical bill for the DNR, some policy changes. I'm going to let Bob take over from here.
Mr. Chairman, members, there should be a fact sheet that's being distributed that describes the bill before you today, and we do have one amendment to offer as well. This is a DNR annual technical bill, and just for the sake of time, I'm going to walk through this rather quickly. Section 1 deals with the scientific and natural areas acquisitions. It allows us to also acquire these units by exchanging. So we're allowing to exchange land for a scientific and natural area. Section 2 deals with the management plans required for these units, and it says that they need to be prepared, we're striking 86A.09. These units, there is no roads or any infrastructure in here. This is a reference that we'd like stricken from that provision. Section 3, Mr. Chairman and members, on page 2, the gist of this provision will allow us to go to an online ATV training program like we have done recently for our firearm safety program that deals with the amount of money we can charge for this. We will continue to provide our hands-on class as well like we do with the firearm safety program. We are working with ATVAM, the ATV Association of Minnesota, to make sure that this language does provide that ability. I believe it does. We just need to clarify that into the future. Page 3, Mr. Chairman and members, Section 4 deals with the technical change on motorized vehicles. Right now, the language says from December 1st to April 1st, no motorized vehicles other than ATVs can be used on these trails. You can't use another motorized vehicle on an ATV or OHV trail anyway, so this is an obsolete reference. Sections 5 and 6 are changing the matching requirements for two trail programs. Currently within the Parks and Trails Legacy Program, the match is 25%. The current match for these other two programs is 50%. So what we're seeing is everyone goes to the 25% match first, then comes back to these other programs. We want to create a level of equity amongst all of our grant programs so people are applying to the appropriate program out of the gate rather than wait and be denied out of one pool and go to the next one. Section 7 and 8, Mr. Chairman, deal with permits that are issued for snowmobiles crossing water and ice. It removes the requirement for the DNR to do this, and it also allows for the local sheriff to deal with this. You can see the language that we're adding on 4.22, adding snowmobile watercross event or practice session that needs to have a permit, and then you can actually, that's the changes that deal with that section there. We have talked to the Sheriff's Association. They are okay with that. Section 9 of the bill deals with the Minerals Coordinating Committee, and these are some technical changes, but we also need to extend the sunset provision. What we're doing is striking the Director of the United States Steelworker of America or their designee. They haven't been attending the meetings, and what you'll see the change here on 5.9, we're adding another member to be added by the governor or another governor's appointee, and that member will represent labor. So it can be from the steelworkers, it could be from the Building and Trades Association, someone who will participate with the group and who should be, that would be appropriate.
Excuse me, Mr. Meyer. Senator Hall, would you like to offer the amendment, or do we need that to put it in order?
That'd be good, yes. I would like to offer the amendment for Senate File 692, Amendment 2.
That's the A2 amendment.
That's
all
correct.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Both same sign.
Thank you.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. As I was saying, this is just a technical change to the Minerals Coordinating Commission, and also it extends the sunset. This committee is set to expire June 30th of 2011. We want to extend that by 5 years. The repealer here on Section 11 deals with the Blakesley Wayside. We're repealing that as a wayside. We're going to manage that unit as part of the WMA that's contiguous to that piece of land. And, Mr. Chairman, the amendment before you deals with the Game and Fish Budget Oversight Committee. This committee was sunsetted last year. It was the extension was contained in the Game and Fish Bill that ended up being vetoed. Our commitment, the department's commitment at that time, was to continue meeting with the group, having them provide input to us. We have been doing that. The language that's before you in the A2 amendment, it contains their recommendations. It consolidates a bunch of smaller groups that we have and makes basically a fisheries oversight committee and a wildlife oversight committee. The budget oversight committee has seen this language. They are supportive of it. And again, because this bill has to go to state and local government, it makes sense to put it on this bill. We can talk about the sunset provision there. So that is the bill and the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Members, any questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Chair. I would move move Senate File 692 as amended to move forward to the state and local government.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Senator Bach. Here. Incidentally, while they're coming up, members, the fiscal implications in the last bill were going to be absorbed by the department. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that before.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring before you Senate File 256, and there is an A1 amendment that the committee should have. And this is the first committee the bill's been in front of.
Mr. Chair, I would offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Saxog offers the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Senator Bach, your bill is in order.
Mr. Chairman, what this appropriation does of $100,000 is it will be the final piece of money that's necessary to make the North Shore Snowmobile Trail roughly from just outside of Two Harbors up to Silver Bay and Finland a multi-use trail. Currently, it's used for snowmobiles. This is going to make some improvements to it so that that additional corridor will be able to use for ATV trails. It's an important link because there is a significant ATV grant and aid trail system around the Two Harbors, Finland area. If you have constituents that ride ATVs, it's one of the more popular places in the state where there actually is a network of ATV trails. So this allows access from further down the North Shore towards Two Harbors to be able to travel up on the North Shore Snowmobile Trail in an environmentally sustainable way to access an existing trail network. The IRRB has already put $125,000 into this this trail improvement. So I have with me Matt Huddleston from Lake County who could speak in more detail to the issue. But, Mr. Chairman of the committee, I'd appreciate your support.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Matt Huddleston. The county coordinator for Lake County. Been working on this project since we started out. Lake County has wanted to be able to do this project along the CJ Ramstead North Shore State Trail corridor going back probably 5 to 10 years. And a big part of the reason we wanted to put the ATV trail in this location is because we're utilizing an existing trail corridor. As Senator Bach stated, we had received some dollars, and we've finished approximately 11.8 miles of the 31 to 32-mile trail. Currently working on what I would call the second 10-mile segment. We have all the permitting in place. We are just looking to finalize buying the wetland credits and move to construction. The third segment, which is the last 10 miles, there's a section of federal property that needs to be crossed, approximately 2.6 miles, and we are currently working with the Forest Service to get a permit. There will probably be some environmental review from the Forest Service, and we're hoping 2012 we could have permission to move forward to finish the construction of the trail in that segment. We have worked with North Shore Mining on an alternative route in case there was some issues with the federal property, and we do have an agreement not formally in place, but there in case we have issues with that to go around the trail. That would add an additional $200,000 of expense, and we're hoping to not have to go that direction. It makes a whole heck of a lot of sense, like I was talking earlier, to stay on the existing trail corridor in that spot. Like I said, Lake County supports it. It provides that corridor with the minimizing the ATV damage, Moose Walk, Moose Run, the Red Dot Trails, which we're trying to connect to up in the Silver Bay, Finland area. Personally, I've been on those trails, and you know it concentrates that traffic on upgraded trails with the appropriate bridges and culverts, and that's what's happened in that area, and we feel that this will happen in this exact area also. We are also had put in for grants for the Federal Recreational Trail Program and are working on a grant for the Parks and Trails Legacy Program, because we're seeking all avenues of funding to finish the project, but hoping this would be a significant part of the funding to get the job done for the trail.
Mr. Huddleston, can you tell me how wide this trail is?
The trail itself, we're working with the DNR as it's also a snowmobile trail. It's going to be roughly between 14 to 16 feet wide.
Any questions, Senator Gazalka?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick question. How close is that to the, I think it's called the Superior Hiking Trails?
It varies depending on the area of the trail, and I also forgot to mention there were two maps that I handed out in color that show the trail from the western end of the county towards the eastern end of the county. Down on the western edge, I think just a small portion of it is very close, but as you move towards the eastern end of the trail, it is they're not really close at all, probably 3-4 miles at least apart. This trail as it runs is about 6 miles inland from Lake Superior, and a lot of times the trail gets down within that 1 mile, 2 miles, except for the very eastern, western portion of the trail. That's fine.
Mr. Bowen, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ray Bowen, and I represent the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota, and we're just here today to say that we strongly support this this request.
Excuse me. Senator Peterson had a – I'm sorry, I missed you there.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Approximately how long is this? It looks like it's about 25 to 30 miles long. Is that correct?
The entire trail is roughly 32 miles.
Okay. Senator, Mr. Chair, member Senator Box, a question for Senator Bach. How fast do you think you can do that 30 miles on a four-wheeler?
Senator, well, I don't know. Do you want to answer that one, Senator
Bach? No.
DNR enforcement is present.
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. Do we have a speed limit for ATVs? I don't even know.
He's shaking his head no.
Shouldn't give anybody any ideas.
Only in Douglas County we did have those. So. Any further questions? Senator, you know that this is going to be referred to Jobs and Industry?
Why would it go there?
Because of the IRRRB. Is that correct? That's what I'm being told.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we don't fund the IRRRB in this, in this committee. Okay. Also, Mr. Chairman, we don't usually fund ATV money through the IRRRB, but, you know, just wanted to bring that up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the reason we thought we better go through IRRRB is IRRRB has been involved in this this development of this trail already. If it goes to DNR, oftentimes we get bogged down between all of the divisions over at the department that don't communicate with each other probably as well as they should. And it just seems like the streamlined process would be to go through the state agency that's already been involved in the trail development.
Senator, that's an economic development group up there. Correct. For that part of the state. So, any further questions, Senator? Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody would like to speak against this. John Lewinsky,
Lincheski.
I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen, my name is John Lincheski. I'm a member of Trout Unlimited. I'm the chair of the Trout and Salmon Stamp Subcommittee of the Budgetary Oversight Committee. We've been very concerned about the conversion of the snowmobile trail to an ATV trail for a number of years because of the potential impacts to all the watersheds on the North Shore. The state has invested a lot of money, a lot of trout stamp money on those fisheries. That this trail would cut across. And we are not opposed to ATV use, far from it. We have many members. I could just guess we maybe half our members are ATV owners or users. But we recognize that some trail locations are not appropriate. And we've been very concerned about this particular trail. It was a snowmobile trail laid out through wetlands for winter use. And now we're talking about ATV use in the summer and just concerned about those impacts. The legislature had a feasibility study done by the DNR in 2005, 2006, and that concluded there would be very significant impacts and that if the trail were converted, it would need to have an EAW done at least, environmental review. My understanding is no environmental review has been done so far. Our concern is that it appears that none will be done, and the entire point of environmental review is it's a mechanism to get better information out there and consider alternative routes, and that's our biggest concern, is that if the trail is going to be built, first of all, we'd say there should be adequate funding to make sure if it needs to be rerouted around steep slopes or around wetlands, there should be the money available for that. But I'm not sure that the process has been allowing for those types of changes in the trail to avoid impacts to dozens of trout and salmon rivers that trail cuts across. So I guess to try and wrap up here, we'd like to make sure that environmental review is done of this effort. I think under the rules, it's pretty clear this is a mandatory EAW category, yet no EAW has been prepared, as far as I'm aware. And again, we'd like to make sure if it's going to be done, there's adequate funding to make sure we do switchbacks around those steep slopes rather than going straight up and down. Works great in the winter. It doesn't work so hot in the summer on an ATV. And then we're most concerned that they follow the DNR has trail building guidelines for ATV trails. I'm not sure that those are necessarily being followed. I think the county is doing an admirable, a good job on trying to avoid wetland impacts, but I'm not sure all the impacts are being looked at, and that's the purpose of environmental review is to make sure that's being done. So, again, I know the Trout and Salmon Stamp Committee has been consistently opposed to this conversion because of the impacts there. If I will say the Red Dot Trail, the Moose Walk Trail, those in the Silver Bay area, great trail. So if there's a way this can be done for sited properly to avoid impacts, great. But it's not clear that the process is being has been followed yet in that regard. So we'd urge caution on this and make sure that whatever funding is provided and not be funneled in such a way to avoid environmental review to improve the project. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Huddleston. You have some comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and committee, I'd like to respond to a couple of those issues there and point out a couple more details on the trail itself. I would say approximately 12 to 15 miles of this 32-mile trail is on an existing railroad grade that has been there for hundreds of years. Culverts are already in place. The bridges are already in place over the existing trout streams that were referenced because of the snowmobile trail. The environmental assessment worksheet, I would say we spent a lot of time looking at this in terms of potential alternative routes. The assessment that was done by the DNR for the entire trail, yes, would need an EAW under a mandatory category. We are only looking to do a part of that. Our project is not the entire North Shore Snowmobile Trail. It's just a portion. And under the existing categories for conversion of 25 miles or more of trail or building 10 new miles, we looked at our trail with the existing miles that are already designated as forest roads, which are some of what we built up a little bit, and there's only a minimal amount of miles, I would say the tune of 15 to 18, that are actually being converted over. And in some of those areas, when we went through the wetland process, they were already been bladed and dozed by the DNR back when they built the North Shore Snowmobile Trail. So when we went out with the Corps of Engineers, the Soil and Water District, our local planning and zoning department, and looked at alternative routes, it made sense through our first wetland permitting of this, the second 10-mile segment, that it stay in the existing corridor of the trail. And likewise, for the last corridor, we looked at and found an alternative route on North Shore mining property, but that would be blazing a virgin trail through many more wetlands than would be on the existing corridor, which under the existing plan only showed one wetland impact on that last 10-mile segment. We also locally in our own ordinance have requirement for a conditional use permit to convert a trail. And we've been through two hearings already with our planning commission looking at this, analyzing the trail, the different routes. And again, we felt this is the best route to build this trail in this location. And as far as steep slopes, again, this is 6 miles inland from
the shore of Lake Superior, which many people are familiar with, the steep topography up in the Silver Bay area and along the shore. This being further inland, the majority of this trail, there's not steep hills and steep bluffs as there is along the shoreline. So those issues don't exist.
Mr. Luchinsky, I would have to ask, were you involved in those public hearings at all? Or was your group there representing?
I was not. Again, without sort of the formal notice process of an EAW, it'd be pretty hard if you didn't live in Two Harbors to know that that was taking place. So I did not participate, but that's kind of the point of the environmental review rules, is to make sure that there's a chance for people to become aware of what's going on and provide a little input and encourage the agencies to look at various aspects, you know, such as the steep slopes in some of these trips. So did not participate. You know, again, it wasn't noticed in the EQB monitor. We would have no way of knowing unless we lived in Two Harbors and got the Lake County Journal.
Mr. Huddleston, you kind of made your case in that you had worked with the DNR on this and also with public meetings. Mr. Linchinsky, I'm wondering, have you contacted the DNR or MPCA or the appropriate agencies at all?
I have contacted the DNR. They indicated to me, actually, in my discussions with them, that they were not working closely with Lake County on it. At least that's what I was told. And that the DNR trails had no regulatory authority as far as the design of the trail. And really the only way that the department touched the trail would be through a waters permit, the water crossings, and specifically if there were culvert crossings. And I applaud the county. They've done a very good job in some aspects of the trail. There's no doubt about it. But it's not clear to me that they're looking at rerouting on some of the locations where maybe they could look at it. And so,
well,
I'm not trying to halt the project. I'm just trying to make sure that it's well sited, as well as it can be, to avoid impacts. Because I think the DNR trails, the Red Dot one and the Moose Walk one, good trails, avoid impacts. So just, I guess, want to make sure that's being done for this much longer trail. It's 30 miles. We're not talking about a little loop somewhere.
Mr. Huddleston's got some more comments.
Mr. Chair, members, again, I feel we did our homework, and this is the right location for the trail through the center of our county for the reasons I had stated earlier. And we are working with our local DNR staff in Two Harbors in terms of what the trail should be like. They're going to have to maintain the snowmobile part. We already have an ATV club that's formed, is interested in potentially taking this over and maintaining it. We're working with them to make sure what trail we build works for the snowmobile trail and also works for the ATV aspect of it. So we have been consulting them and any help we can get, and we do have the manual that was referred to in terms of from the DNR on building trails, and our land department has been working on those standards and putting together the specs when we bid out the first segment of our trail, and also had a consultant on board to help us through the permitting process. And the trail. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, I think the point is, because the trail is as short as it is, when you take out the forest road sections that we allow ATVs on under current law, there's no requirement in law for an EAW. It's not required because there's minimal impact.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I move the bill. Do you want it in your...
Senator Langseth moves Senate File 256 as amended to be referred to the Jobs and Industry. Is that correct?
I guess, yeah. Go on.
Any further questions? Any comments? Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman of the Committee.
Let's see who we got.
Make it quick, John.
Are you prepared to go? Senator Carlson, Senate File 418, Upper Mississippi Comprehensive Plan Grant Appropriation. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. A couple of weeks ago, we had a presentation by former Representative Paul Teeny, and who is now the chair of the Mississippi Headwaters Board. I think Representative Teeny did a good job of explaining what the Mississippi Headwaters Board does. And what we need to do to continue their fine work is to give them some appropriation money so that they can continue. What they need to do is, right now, they don't have enough money to be able to afford an executive director. They have barely enough money for papers to send out to committee members. What we're looking for is some money to help out along with the money that they will be getting from the counties involved so that they could ramp up their staff. The biggest concern that we have, if we don't ramp up the Mississippi Headwaters Board, that region, the whole upper portion of the Mississippi River could fall back down under federal control, and I think we want to avoid that. And so what Senate File 418 does is appropriate $130,000 for both fiscal years 2012 and 2013 in order to help fund that project. I would stand for questions. I don't think we needed to belabor what the good that the Mississippi Headwater Board does.
Senator Saxok.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I think that the other thing that was brought up the other day in our testimony was that that this leverage is a lot of money and a lot of in-kind money. We were talking up to $700,000 a year, were we, with the counties along the
Senator Carlson
along the river?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Saxog, I don't remember the exact amount, and Senator Saxog's, I think, memory is probably a little better than mine, but he's absolutely correct. It does leverage a lot of money, and we do some really – they do really good work on that. I think there's many members of the committee here that Mississippi Headwaters affects. Starts out in Senator Scoia's district, actually, continues on through Senate District 4, on into Senator Saxog's district, down into Senator Gazelka's district. It's just a fine board that's doing good work, but they're just strapped for cash.
Questions from the committee? Hearing none, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that the committee recommend this bill to be passed and be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Senator Gerlach. Oh, I'm sorry, Tom Sony. You know what, as the good senator knows, it gets to be a lot of scratch about this time of the committee here, and I'm bypassing and going here and there. But Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senate File 399 is in reference to the minerals management account, and what it does is it makes a little change to the account so that I think what was an oversight when the account was set up is corrected, and it actually deals with the fairness of how the money gets distributed. What the minerals management account does is it allows the DNR to take 20% off of any royalty monies that are coming in from taconite money or mining, minerals mining as well as logging, and they get it from the lands that are being used by the permanent school fund, by the university fund, and by tax forfeited land. And currently what happens is that 20%, if it goes above $3 million and there's more than $3 million in the account as of June 30th, then the DNR has to give the money back according to the proportion from which they got the money. They give it back only to the permanent university fund and to the permanent school fund. Well, some of the money comes from tax forfeited lands also, and so it's only correct that the money also would be redistributed back to the tax forfeited lands. So what this does is just makes this equitable, and I don't think there's anybody opposing this that I know of.
Members, any questions? No questions?
Move the bill.
Senator Higgins. Move Senate File 399 to pass for possible inclusion in the environmental omnibus bill. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Sorry to make you wait so long for such a short short event here.
It's always Senator worth Gerlach. It. It's always worth it to watch you guys work. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what my motion is. Is it
Commerce.
Commerce. Oh, good. Can we do that?
I'm sure we get that far.
Hey, hello.
Mr. Gerlach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is Senate File 356 relating to the Petroleum Tank Cleanup Fund. And members, there's two parts to this bill. The first one is simply an extension of the sunset. This fund has been around for a number of years. In fact, I have some gentlemen here to talk about, and he can certainly answer any history if you have any questions if you're not familiar with it. This fund really crosses over three agencies as far as its use: the Department of Commerce, the Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED, and also the PCA. All three agencies play a role in this, and the fund is there for the cleanup of petroleum tanks that are leaking. There's a board. There are people who will apply for grants from this fund, and it's a fee that blinks on and blinks off depending on the amount in the fund. And it's a fund that has worked well. Every 5 years, it comes up for a sunset, and we have to decide as a legislature whether this is worthy of continuing on. So I've asked those questions that normally we would ask of a sunsetting program. Is it working? Does it work for the folks that are using it? Does it work for the agency? Does the funding mechanism make sense? And all of those questions, and the answers to that are yes. So this bill seeks to extend the sunset for another 5 years for a program that's working well. There's a second part of the bill that adds some language in dealing with used oil, and for that we'll have Mr. Krogman talk about that. So, members, unless there's any initial questions of me, I'll have my testifiers explain what their perspective is on the bill.
Mr. Krogman, welcome to the committee. State your name, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. When the petrol fund was first created, there was a million-gallon threshold put in above which a facility would not be eligible for reimbursement. That was there so pipeline terminals and refineries wouldn't drain the fund, essentially. What this section of the bill does is move that exclusion over a million gallons for those people who store used oil as well as other refined products. Used oil is a unique product. These folks have all the tanks at the county garages, city garages, wherever do-it-yourselfers put their used oil, transported back to their facility, and they're stored all winter long. It's sold during the summer for use as fuel in hot mix plants. And over the past couple of years, there's been less usage. They've carried more over. Their combination of station storage, bulk plant storage, and used oil storage could put them over, would put them over a million gallons in a couple instances. This would say that if there were a spill, a leak at their refined fuel system or even the used oil, it could be reimbursable through Petrofund.
Okay. Any questions? You have also with you Mr. Fisher?
Yes, Mr. Fisher from the department. If you'd like to.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Fisher. I'm the director of the Petrofund program at the Department of Commerce. And I guess my main point I want to make for the committee is that the main reason for the extension, or that the Commerce Department is supporting the extension of the Petrofund is that without this, the tank owners in Minnesota would basically be left without financial assurance coverage, which is a federal requirement that they have up to $1 million worth of financial assurance. So they would be left to find, basically left to their own means to pay for these cleanups, which can be quite expensive. Right now in Minnesota, there are approximately 1,100 open leak sites. We get about 350 to 400 new ones every year. So that's basically why we're supporting this.
Any questions from the members? Seeing none, Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make the motion that Senate file 356 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Last bill.
Could you haze him a little bit? This is his first chance to chat.
Or if you feel like making an offer.
Really?
So, okay.
Sorry to keep you waiting.
It doesn't incorporate your
comments.
Okay. Senator Angerbredson, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate file 675 was a department bill brought to me, and it regards to the cybers and the comprehensive incidental-based reporting system, which sounds quite confused, so I'm going to turn it over to my presenter here with me from the DNR.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Major Rodman Smith, Operations Manager for DNR Enforcement. There is a fact sheet on this bill. There's basically two sections to the bill. The first section is a clarification that the Department of Natural Resources Division of Enforcement is a law enforcement agency that is able to participate in the BCA CrimNet Cybers. It's a comprehensive incident-based reporting system. We've talked with the BCA, and they have no objections to us coming on board with that program. And then Section 2 is repealing a sunset on the use of silenced firearms for wildlife control. Currently, we are using the department is actually contracting through statute with the USDA APHIS to use silenced firearms for the control of cormorants, like in the Leech Lake area. We've used the silenced firearms to control, to depopulate some deer in the TB area up in northwestern Minnesota. We've used silenced firearms to, or contracted with APHIS to use silenced firearms to depopulate a large elk producing facility when there's found to be CWD in that facility. And we are currently contracting with USDA APHIS to use silenced firearms down in the southeastern part of the state to finish the sample size that we need to determine whether or not CWD is present. In current statute, our authority to use or to contract with APHIS would sunset July 1st, 2011. We'd just like to have that repealed so that we're able to continue to use those silenced firearms for wildlife and disease control. And that's basically the two sections of the bill, and I could stand for questions.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has more to do with how did you get there? I'm just kidding.
Practice.
Sorry, I can't answer that.
Are there any other testifiers that you have, Senator Ingebretson?
I have none.
Anybody in the audience that wants to testify for or against the bill? Senator Ingebretson.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 675 to pass and refer to Judiciary and Public Safety.
Senator Ingebretson recommends that we pass Senate File 675 and refer to Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you very much, committee. And there's one announcement before we go.
Thank you,
Senator Peterson,
Mr. Chair, and members. Yeah, I just have to take this last opportunity today to announce the St. Cloud evening at the Capitol starting right now at 5 o'clock down at the St. Paul Hotel. It's a beautiful venue and great food, so we'd love to see you down there. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
Being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.
Thank you, sir.